Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day. Shunyata Karuna Garbham. Shunyata, shunya actually is an interesting word in that it's connected to the word swell, like swell up. And so, because a seed, when it gets moistened, tends to swell, you know, before when you plant a seed, and then the sprout can come out of its DNA and it, or whatever, you know. So it comes from creating the space where things can grow, relational things can grow. It is not a nothingness type word, really. But anyway, voidness. You have to have a space in which something grows. And then karuna means compassion, and karu means something like pleasure, and na means no. So karuna means stopping pleasure, actually, literally. And because happiness is pleasure, it's bliss. And then when you love someone, then it's your bliss overflows and wants them to have bliss. And but when you have compassion for them, then you stop your bliss because you become aware of their suffering. And then you want to remove their suffering. So shunyata, the idea is that the voidness becomes the womb of compassion, because within the voidness, compassion grows, if you follow me. And it's particularly lovely in Tibetan, the translation, dong nid ning je ning bo jen, because it has three sounds that are like ning. Dong nid ning je ning bo jen. Three ni sounds, so I love it. But it was Atisha's favorite word, Nagarjuna's favorite word. It's really a marvelous word, a marvelous phrase. And it replaces our wrong idea that voidness is or emptiness is some kind of dark blank space, with the idea that voidness is everything's interconnected. It's the plenum of all interconnected things, is what that means. There's no non-connected thing anywhere in it, right? So that's, as far as the expression things about explaining, there's a famous Zen statement in the Blue Cliff Record that's very funny. I know it from the translation by Thomas Cleary, where some Zen master in a comment on a koan says, from the moment he attained enlightenment until he left that particular embodiment, the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, never said a single word. And then it said, then the Zen master says, such a garrulous non-speaking filled the Dragon King's cave with scriptures. Which I like. So the idea that the ultimate reality is inexpressible, which is a clear idea that they're very clear about. You know, you cannot capture reality by any kind of word or concept or formula of any kind. You know, it's not possible. But that gives you license to express a lot of vectors, a lot of things that help people critically remove any ideas of unreality. That they make them confused about what is reality. And then remember also, not only is ultimate reality inexpressible, but ultimately eating an apple is inexpressible, isn't it? You can talk about this and juicy and red and crunch and sweet and you know, it keeps the doctor away, you can go on and on. But actual crunching that apple is beyond the greatest poet. They can never really capture the experience of eating the apple, right? So in a way, because everything is ultimate reality, actually, if you fully experience it. And it's all inexpressible, luckily. But therefore, we express a lot. Because we're having a conversation, all of us, in our mind and in our cultures and our history and our education, that is all delusional, you know. And we're stuck in it. We think that's all. We're running after it, running hither and thither, right? Aren't we? So then anything that can express any way of getting free of that is helpful. And, you know, His Holiness Dalai Lama, he was very moving in the interview. Because I asked him, were there amazing, what was his most amazing breakthrough in life? And he said that he realized that he was reading a certain book, and he explained exactly what passage he was in the book. And then he had something about personal selflessness. And then he had something like electric shock in his heart center, he said. It's like electricity. And then this deepened slowly in the noughts, recently actually, not even early. We had some earlier thing, but in the noughts particularly. And then he said, and after that, when he said, I'm in a large crowd, it looks, seems to me like the whole huge audience is like a mirage. And I feel like a mirage, he said. And I said, well, does it make you happy? Oh, yes, he said. It's very excellent. Because the emptiness, selflessness and emptiness idea, it gives you a kind of immunity to being swept away by the different addictive emotions, you know, and being too attached to this or to that, you know. And so he was sort of revealing perhaps his secret of why, in the midst of still being frustrated by the Chinese government and not being able to see his people and, you know, whatever, not resolving the situation, he still remains happy, although not unrelenting in his wish to that others should be happy as well.
So those are fabulous questions. I'm curious about the ones you forgot.
Those
are great questions. What was your list?
There was more things about sort of view of the world, and, you know, he likes to debate with me, you know, because we've known each other for 51 years, you know, so he likes to find something wrong if I say, something like that. Anyway, never mind. Another question. I'm only standing here because there's a question, a microphone. Where's the mic?
I was curious about what is the Kala Chakra initiation? You referred
what
to
is it.
What
is it?
What is it?
Yes. Kala Chakra is a really wonderful concept that literally means, Kala Chakra literally means wheel of time. And it's a form of Buddha that, and historically Buddhists think, Tibetan Buddhists and Indian Buddhists before them, they think that it's a form that Shakyamuni Buddha himself manifested in his life in South India. At the same time as he was teaching the Transcendent Wisdom Sutra in his ordinary body in Vulture Peak in Rajagriha in North India, he manifested as this being with 24 arms and 4 faces and just 2 legs, one red and one white, and in union with a consort, and who was golden colored. And he manifested that for some people who beamed down from Shambhala, a country somewhere in the area of the North Pole. You know? I mean, it's very sci-fi, okay? The legend of it is very, very sci-fi, like Star Trek or something. That's why I like sci-fi, because it's like ancient Buddhist view of the cosmos. But what's most important about it is that that body of the Buddha, however, whatever the real history of it is, whether it's that or something else, everything is made of time. Like the 24 arms, you know, then you have 5 fingers in the 24 hands, and 5 times 24 is 360, 120, right? And then there are 3 joints in each finger, and so that's 360, so they are the days of the year, you know, et cetera. I mean, and everything, the 4 seasons, the 4 phases. And so the idea is, I mean, from earliest time, each level of Buddhism, Buddha is said to be one who, enlightenment, when you attain enlightenment, all the past and future is equally available to you. So the moment contains all moments of the past and all moments of the future. When Buddha was under the tree, in every description of Buddha's enlightenment, he remembered infinite previous lives of himself and of other beings also. And then he saw all different possible future destinies of other beings as well at the same time. So they have an expression, triadvajna, in Sanskrit, which has, a similar thing in Pali, meaning one who knows the 3 times. So Buddha had a bodhisattva vow, right? And the bodhisattva vow is, I will not become totally free of suffering and attain nirvana until all beings are free of suffering. So how could he attain nirvana and leave us here in New York City or in the Catskill Mountains, you know, in bad weather, and then with global warming? How could he do that? Did he break his bodhisattva vow? And that should be a logical question. So in a way, the Kala Chakra form is an answer, and the whole yoga that connects to it is an answer to that question, in the sense that, you know, it's like a being, it's an evolution, being in its evolution toward its own perfect enlightenment, which is a time when that being becomes infinite and infinitely wise in the sense of experiences themselves as reality in its infinitude, and also has infinite compassion, therefore, for every other being, which is how Buddhahood is defined. And then one is evolving in that direction, hopefully. But it's like a flower. You couldn't take a seed and like pull the blossom out of it. You could just put the best, you know, fertilizer, soil, moisture, greenhouse, you know, whatever it would take to have its optimal growing pattern. But it would take its own time to grow, right? Because it's a relative object with its sort of thing. So beings do need the time to do it. But if you attain an experience where you know the different futures of the beings, but and it's not just passive because there is no absolute fate. We could stubbornly remain ignorant and to commit negative actions and create negative spaces for ourselves life after life after life, endlessly, basically. We could. But if we have help of a very competent being, like at crossroads and appearing to us in this way and helping us learn that thing, there's a kind of maybe an optimal evolutionary path. So the Kala Chakra idea is that Buddha is present throughout all time, and his compassion is there to help every being evolve in the maximum possible, optimal way, you could say, something like that. And so it's a vision of Buddhahood like that that is really very exquisite. It really is marvelous. And so what the initiation is that is at a very advanced level where one has really become free enough of being gripped by the addictive passions of hatred and lust and greed and jealousy and pride and this sort of thing, and egotism, where one can use these deep unconscious energies in a conscious way. So without, you know, having an object of lust or an object of hatred, but the idea of the fire of it, that kind of fiery energy, and not be taken by it, but use it to remove negativities and things like that, etc. And creativity, and the desire energy becomes a creative thing. That's called Tantra, sort of advanced thing, defined as what happens after the world based on ignorance has been destroyed in a certain way to recreate a more beautiful world for other beings. That's what it's really defined as. And to be initiated means to enter into the DNA pattern of that Buddha form, and then slowly progress, and then accelerate the progression through that. And then it's a meditative thing where, why does a bodhisattva, once you take a bodhisattva vow, you express a determination to spend 3 incalculable aeons of lifetimes doing bodhisattva deeds, like giving your body, giving your time, giving your, you know, whatever, tolerating whatever injury, sacrificing yourself, meditating, learning, whatever, life after life after life. But, you know, then each life is a long, cumbersome process. Then you die, then you have to be reborn again, then you have to find out what to do, then you have to do it again. And it goes on because it's an evolutionary vision. So what the Tantra does in that mandala universe of the Kala Chakra, or there are other ones as well as Kala Chakra, many other ones, then one goes into a subtle plane where you live and die like 1,000 times in a dream state or something like that, in a night. You know, like someone like Milarepa lived in a cave in the winter, and then he would live and die a million times in like 6 months or something like that, you know, and therefore evolve in such a generate what they call the merit and the wisdom and the intuition to reach Buddhahood much, much faster. You know, and the reason for doing faster is not just a greed of wanting sort of the bliss of infinite Buddhahood right away yourself, but it is that you get... They say that someone reaches a certain stage, shunyata karuna garbham, and then they can't bear the suffering of others. And then why should they have to wait 3 aeons for me to be able to help them effectively? And then, and also there's a little element of, well, Buddhas are supposedly already helping them all totally, but they're doing a crappy job. Sometimes it looks like they're not getting it done, so I'm going to do something more. You know, there's an attitude like that, right? So that's the Kala Chakra thing is an introduction to that. But on the other hand, when His Holiness, there's a tradition in Tibet of giving it a few times to the mass of the population, which is imitating what supposedly in the mythical country of Shambhala happens every year, And they don't think that everybody who's getting it is capable of the yogas involved with it. But they consider it kind of a blessing if one approaches it with a positive attitude and sees it in a... And especially, have you ever seen the powder mandala, the color particle mandala? Have you ever seen a live one? It's amazing. The first time I saw that in 1965, a voice sounded in my own head. I don't know who it was. It was my Walter Cronkite voice. And it said, if human beings can make anything that beautiful, Buddhahood must be possible. Mm. It really, and I, okay, Walter. You said it. CBS said it, you know, so then I believed it. And I've been crawling around after it ever since, you know. But it's tricky stuff, on the other hand. If people wrongly think that just by getting initiated, then suddenly I'm a big tantric yogi, then one can be led astray, actually. Because when it starts to bring out, it's like the emotions, you know, the deep unconscious emotions are powerful, you know. And you have to have a level of sort of ability to not be swept away by them, type of thing. They say. Another question.
Bob, what's the sand mandala there?
What?
Which sand
mandala? This mandala, this color particle mandala, is a version of the medicine Buddha, which in a way it's a three-dimensional illustration of this particular form of the medicine Buddha and that painting, which has the 52 beings around it, the eight medicine Buddhas, and then certain bodhisattvas, and then some different kinds of deities, and so on. And it connects with the Indian and Tibetan medicine, Buddhist medicine. And it has in the center a book, actually, this one, which represents the... And then the eight medicine Buddhas are represented by eight bowls, monastic bowls, which have myrobalan fruit in them, which are a panacea-type medicine, the myrobalan plant, like a nut that is ground up in all Buddhist medicines. And then there's 52 different symbolic things in the little sections of it. And what such a mandala is, it's an initiatory thing usually, which is only made for a ceremony where someone is introduced to the vision of this sort of special space or alternative universe of that kind of Buddha form. But they let us keep this one because the Menla mission is to try to make available to the world the Buddhist medicine view, which is that the world is there to support human life, and it is not inimical to human life. And if one understands what it is, everything is medicine, sort of type of idea. It's an idea like that. And it's actually a blueprint for a three-dimensional space, a palace, a mansion in the middle of a certain kind of universe. Down in the spa, in the one of these reproductions of these 77 paintings that were made in the 17th century, by the fifth Dalai Lama's regent, there's a depiction of the medicine Buddha universe. It's down there in the spa front room, and you can see that. That's what that is. But that's a little different kind. But on the other hand, it's a wonderful thing, because if you're a healer or a doctor, part of your medical school training is to enter the mandala of the medicine Buddha, and there are different traditions of that, and then you learn to be the medicine Buddha in your vision, in your visualization, and you develop stability in that visualization, and you sort of get that vision of beings as potentially well and healthy and made of good health and so forth. And it's a good method to cultivate your compassion for them and renew that your motivation is to help them and heal them and not just to make money or be a famous doctor or whatever, patent some drug or whatever they do in commercial medicine, you know, industrial, what I call industrial medicine. And it's part of your medical school training. It would be as if in modern medical schools, instead of taking the Hippocratic Oath just before going out and opening up your office after school, you had like a major course in every semester about the Hippocratic Oath and about what you're really trying to do, why you are becoming a doctor or a nurse or whatever it is that you're doing. They would really train in that, where you'd become Hippocrates. You know, you'd meditate, I'm Hippocrates, and I'm going to really save this and that person. And that would be the core motivation of a doctor, they say. So then they do that. And they don't go around saying, I'm medicine Buddha, I'm number one, I'm medicine Buddha, I'm going to heal you. No, they don't do that. but they never mention it, but yet they create a space in their office and everything where they visualize, they restore their sort of sense of optimism in dealing with the difficult sufferings of the ill people. You know, it's really lovely. It's a lovely idea, actually. Another question.
Would you mind sitting back on the stage?
Oh, sorry. Poor it's just cameraman. I go to hear the question.
The room is just too dark.
Okay, okay.
Another question?
That's the lady had a question. Yes.
So I had a question. If I understood what you said correctly, you said that. Sorry. You said that loving kindness is the kind of love, the compassion that comes from that is like a mother's love or a friend's love. And I'm wondering, according to Buddhist philosophy, if that can also exist in romantic love.
I got the beginning.
Can the loving kindness exist in romantic love?
Sure.
As well as the
not only that.
Mother to a child?
If you want the romantic love to last, it better exist. The sort of hot and heavy, grabby stuff has its own duration, you know, and it has its own delights, but to last, there has to be the will to the happiness of the other, you know. And that's the famous thing of Shantideva, you know, all suffering in this world, the great Shantideva, the guide to the Bodhisattva way of life, or there are different versions of the translation, is that all the suffering in this world comes from wishing one's own happiness, and all the joy in this world comes from wishing others' happiness. He makes an argument that is so excellent about that. And every year in my academic classes, I issued to my students the Shantideva Challenge to tell me about when it was that they got happiness by just wanting their own happiness and going around. Because he argues that the sure way of being unhappy is to only think about what would make me happy. Because as soon as you evaluate how happy you are and what you're getting out of whatever, it'll never be enough. And you'll always want something more and you'll be dissatisfied. And So quote unquote romantic love, if there's a lot of possessiveness in it from both sides, at first it's kind of fun if it's requited, and the two are really, really turned on by the idea that the other one loves me, and then they really go crazy, and of course everybody else hates them, you know, Romeo and Juliet, they all want to have them assassinated because they really love each other and they just go off in their own dream world together. And but then the fatal question moment comes where one of them thinks, well, does she love me as much as I love her? Oh, who's doing more loving here? And what am I getting out of it? And then that's the honeymoon is over, you know, there's that expression. So if the honeymoon is to last a lifetime, it has to have the loving kindness aspect, you know, definitely. The mutual support of the others. You know, spiritual unfoldment and spiritual fulfillment, each one fulfilling the other one, then that one will last, type of thing.
So can I just ask a follow-up question?
Yes, sure.
So why did you make the point of pointing out the mother's love and the friend's love? Are they distinct? Or
why they point out about a mother's love?
Yeah. Why are those the examples, the mother's love to a child and a friend's love?
Yeah.
Well, that's the etymology of the word. Maitri in Sanskrit or metta in Pali comes from mitra, friend, or mater, mother, which are Sanskrit words, you know. And in the meditation on love, one version of how to cultivate the bodhisattva mind or the mind of love and compassion involves meditation where you visualize all beings as having been your mother. And of course, Tibetan lamas complain in the West that a lot of people have conflicted relationships with their mothers, and therefore, why do I have to think about my mother? You know, she gave me such a hard time. But, you know, when you were suckling, when you were helpless suckling, which you don't remember, then you were not having personality conflicts with your mother. Your mother was milk. Your mother was a loving face. You know, although some people, even if they were orphans or something, somebody had to hold them and be nice to them, except in the horrible pre-50s America, where they had a theory that you couldn't hold babies because they'd get germs, and then those people had stunted brains, actually. There were studies. Brain growth comes from being groomed and touched and held and caressed. It's very, very critical. So all human beings, so that's the Dalai Lama's real basis of his whole my religion is kindness kind of theory, is the scientific studies that show that the human youth is so helpless, so dependent for so long, even past adolescent, although none of them will believe it in this country. But the parents, actually, but now they're living at home at 50, I think, nearly. And some of them, a lot of them. But that you know, depending on the kindness of stranger is a human thing, you know, and being helpless and needing interdependency. So that means that the human form has a kind of, at its root, developmental, relational root, not an absolute root, because, of course, humans can be worse than anybody with nuclear weapons and things, but any animal, but because of the cleverness. But still, the human form is basically a very gentle form, you know, no scales, no armor, no poison claws, you know, no big fangs, except in Hollywood, you know, vampires and things. But otherwise, human form is gentle and vulnerable kind of being, you know. So that's the thing. And the mother thing is, of course, the reason that's a symbol is that's the most self-sacrificing, most altruistic, biological, without any special thing, is the mother thing. And actually, therefore, I believe, and I think in Tantra, in the Tantra, almost like a secret thing, within all the male chauvinist cultures in which Buddhism has existed in the last 2,500 years, the female is more close to enlightenment than the male. More developed than the male, not less. Because the female has more, because enlightenment is altruism to the extreme case. It's not just some light bulb popping off where you sort of see in the distance something. It's feeling the feeling of others. It's empathy with others. It's in that direction anyway. And the female naturally has an advantage in that direction. And the male is more like, tends to be more, you know how they are. You know the you know the famous joke? You never heard the famous joke. Why does it take so many sperm to fertilize one egg? Do you know why? Because they never want to stop to ask for directions. They won't pull over at the gas station. She keeps saying, dear, why don't you go ask? No, I'll find it. You know, that's the male. They want to be disconnected, you know, and they want to do it all themselves. They're like that. A little bit crazy, you know. Female knows that we're all dependent and interconnected automatically. So actually, that puts them ahead of the male, in fact, in the direction of, if they knew that was the direction of enlightenment. Unfortunately, too many mystical, not just Buddhism, but other traditions teach that enlightenment is some sort of a poof where the world disappears and you're flying off in some sort of like space or something, golden space or something, and it's all, and nobody's around, it's just you. Some really totally psychotic, self-centered, escapist ideas, unfortunately, what most mystics promote as enlightenment. But enlightenment is total, where you are totally. Poor Buddha. They say Buddha feels like a mother feels about her only beloved child, about every single sentient being. So that's when you become infinite, where you are one with all the beings, and then you have to worry about them because they're still there. They're not dissolved into nothing. But luckily, if you see they're made of the clear light of the void, and they have that. They're going to find their own reality, and you can help them effectively to do it. It's not overwhelming, supposedly. I don't know.
I think we're done.
We're done? Okay. We're done. Time. Thank you.
Poem by Muriel Rukeyser, who lived from 1913 to 1980, an American poet. I lived in the first century of world wars. Most mornings I would be more or less insane. The newspapers would arrive with their careless stories. The news would pour out of various devices, interrupted by attempts to sell products to the unseen. I would call my friends on other devices. They would be more or less mad for similar reasons. Slowly I would get to pen and paper, make my poems for others unseen and unborn. In the day I would be reminded of those men and women, brave, setting up signals across vast distances, considering a nameless way of living, of almost unimagined values. As the lights darkened, as the lights of night brightened, we would try to imagine them, try to find each other, to construct peace, to make love, to reconcile waking with sleeping, ourselves with each other, ourselves with ourselves. We would try by any means to reach the limits of ourselves, to reach beyond ourselves, to let go the means, to wake. I lived in the first century of these wars. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.